Today on Vox Talks Economics, the history of forced displacement and what we can learn from it. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. The Syrian refugee crisis, Venezuelans fleeing to Colombia and Brazil, the exodus from the war in Ukraine. Today, forced migration is constantly in the news, but these events have been happening for hundreds of years. In the last decade, economic historians have created exciting new research on these historical episodes of forced displacement. And Sasha Becker of Monash University, the University of Warwick and the CPR is the author of what he calls an eclectic overview of the history of forced displacement. And he joins me now to talk about it. Sasha, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim.
Sasha, why is it that economic historians have increasingly been researching, looking at forced displacement?
I think it's a mix of two things. On one hand, in the last decade or so, we've seen large waves of forced migration. The Syrian refugee crisis that you mentioned comes to mind, Venezuela. And clearly people then start to say, wait a minute, did that happen earlier in history as well? And can we learn anything from that? Or is that a new thing? And then people have systematically tried to dig into history to see when similar things happened and try to research those periods. The other is that I think there had been a lot of work on World War II, broadly speaking, and also that brought with it a lot of forced migration. And with what we call the digital revolution in history, people digitizing large amounts of data, suddenly you could try and understand those episodes, and more young and old scholars got into it.
So what's our definition of forced migration? Does it have to be a certain number of people moving? Is it easy to distinguish the push, the forcing, from the pull of other places?
Yeah, let me start with the push and pull thing, because that is the framework that is usually used to understand voluntary migration. That, say, a push factor could be you live in a place that has high unemployment rates and you see life is better elsewhere. And so that's a pull, the opportunities you have if you were to move. In the context of forced migration, a lot, if not all of it, is push. Yeah? So suddenly your life is being threatened, your livelihood is being taken away, your house burns down, be it because someone sends bombs or also natural disasters is thing that people have looked at. That is what defines forced displacement. And it can be few people, it can be many people. Thinking about the Middle Ages, there were Jewish settlements here and there in German cities, and often it was just one family or two or three families. And at some point, a Christian majority would go after the Jews and send them away and remove their settlement rights. So it can be small numbers. But it can also be, of course, millions. And in the context of World War II, we saw 12 million Germans being forcefully moved and 2 million Poles. Today, we see in front of our own eyes already 3 or 4 million Ukrainians displaced across borders and even more within borders. It's just crazy.
Can we learn from history in this area? Does the research on forced migration tell us something that would help make better policy today?
I think it does. What the historic research gives us that current events don't yet shed light on is the long-run effects. When we deal with a refugee crisis like the one we are right now in with the Ukrainian refugees, then it's all about just managing disaster and trying to help these people find shelter and give them refuge and give them a place of abode. But what we can learn from history is what are the effects both on the migrants, but also on the receiving populations and on the areas where they are expelled from in the long run over one, two, three generations. And that is a view that I think is super important, because right now we are just trying to manage things. And there may be also concerns about populism and whether that fosters right-wing activists who say, oh, we don't want all of these refugees. Why don't they go elsewhere? Why do they come to my country? And we see maybe these concerns, And over all of that, we forget that maybe after a generation, this is just a little episode of history, and the benefits accumulate both for the migrants and for the receiving population. So let me give you an example of some work I did myself with four co-authors some years ago of forced migration after World War II. And it plays out in pretty much the same area that today's conflict is happening. So after World War II, Germany lost the war, and then Germany's borders were moved west, and lots of German refugees had to move to the west of Germany from the formerly eastern parts of Germany. And at the same time, the Soviet Union expanded and swallowed parts of what used to be Poland. So Poland as a country moved 300 kilometers west. And all the Poles that used to be in the eastern part of the former Poland were forced to migrate further west. This happened 1945, 46. So this is now 8 decades ago. And we can ask today, how did these refugees fare over two or three generations? So what we do in that work is to ask whether the so-called uprootedness hypothesis is true. So what is that? So the idea of the uprootedness hypothesis is that people who lost all of their assets, all their belongings, their house, and could barely carry one or two suitcases from place A to B to save their skin. What happens with these people in terms of education? With those that are already adults, do they go to evening school? Do they try to learn something new? But especially their kids, the hypothesis is that if you lose your physical belongings, then the lesson you draw from that is that maybe in future you want to invest in portable assets. And education is a portable asset. No one can take away your education. And what we find is that indeed among those refugees, compared to other Polish people who were not forced to migrate, the kids and the grandchildren of these people are more educated than all other Poles today. So that suggests that this desire to invest in education is very strong. And in the Polish case, these people moving essentially within Poland, from the old part of Poland to a new part of Poland, were welcome to go to school from day one, and they made the most of it. So what's the lesson? I think now that we have millions of Ukrainian refugees arrive in all parts of Europe, there is a risk that since we are just trying to manage the pure numbers, and that we content ourselves with giving them shelter, now they are safe, but then bureaucracy may kick in about, oh, how do we do about schools? Maybe the war is over soon. Maybe if they just stay in a refugee camp for a few months, they can return to Ukraine. And the kids in all of that may be forgotten and may not go to school at all. So I think it's super important that also today we give immediate and full access to education to the kids of refugee families so that they can make the most of this terrible situation they're in.
I think that's a great example of just how many interesting questions there are coming out of this. Your discussion paper, you were very clear that you couldn't include all of the research in it. As you said, you called it an eclectic overview. But what were your criteria for what you put in and what you had to leave out?
So the starting point for this particular survey was an earlier one I did some years ago with a PhD student of mine, Andy Ferrar. We had tried to survey the literature not only in historic times, but also in modern times. And that already was hard enough. But then with a lecture I had to give recently at a conference, I then again had to take stock. And so one inclusion criterion was that I try to capture whatever new research there was in the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And there has been a true explosion. It's just amazing how many PhD students, postdoc, young, middle-aged, old scholars have got into this research area. And so I try to get all of that in whenever it fit my criterion of what is history. And my criterion was I was born in 1973. So whatever happened before 73 is history. So I tried to do that. But then a literature that I wasn't so much aware of, because I had always focused a bit more on Europe and North America, is there is a lot of work also on the removal of indigenous populations. And that happened pretty much all the places where Anglo-Saxons arrived as colonizers, be it the US, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. And there, as the colonizers arrived, one of my colleagues at ANU, Boyd Hunter, he says, the history of colonization is the history of displacement. So if indigenous peoples weren't killed right away, they would often just be moved to a place where they were, so to say, out of the way and didn't interfere with the settlers. And then even after those arrangements had been made well into the 20th century, there were policies that tried to, in Australia, it was the White Australia policy, so Aboriginals were no longer killed, but the Australians tried to make them as much Australian as they could be in the view of those White Australians. So kids were taken away from their families, were put into boarding schools, and were educated in a way that try to remove any memory of their upbringing and about their beautiful heritage. And that research is also what I try to at least touch on in this survey, and where I think a lot more work can still be done. And it's so important to do it.
There is so much to talk about from this discussion paper. But first of all, I want to talk about the data. Whenever we do economic history on Vox Talks, I am always impressed by the heroic efforts of the researchers to go back into the archives and scrape data. In this area of migration, what sort of data is becoming available that's driving research?
I think it's important to notice that economics as a discipline, and economic history as well, is more and more moving to the direction of the sciences. Like having labs, more or less. You need large groups of people to do research just because archives are huge and you are dealing with maybe millions of observations of historic censuses. And it's quite different from the research that maybe I did as a PhD student 20 years ago when I just had a CD-ROM with data from the OECD and some macro statistics about GDP. I put the CD-ROM into the drive and immediately started running statistical analysis. Now, Claudia Golden from Harvard, she always says economic historians are detectives. So it's about, first of all, finding the sources. And once you found them, you have to make sense of them. And it's on one hand, census records, but also shipping lists. Lots of people have looked into Jewish refugees arriving from Europe to North America, and then Ellis Island, where most of these ships pass by, has the shipping lists and who passed through. Then there is newspaper archives. People now try to draw some inference on what was the atmosphere at the time, how were refugees being talked about. And all of that comes together, and only really large teams can handle the sheer amount of data before you even get to the point of doing a statistical analysis.
So let's see if we can draw some conclusions from the research that's been done. You've already touched on the Polish experience, but what can we say in general about labour market outcomes or educational outcomes for forced migrants?
There has been a lot of research on is the post-World War II experience. And we talked about the Polish case, similarly also for these 12 million German refugees that moved further west. And then also in Finland, the Soviets invaded in the early World War II. We have similar data. In all of these cases, people move ultimately within their own country. So the borders shift, but Germans move from part of Germany that no longer is into another part of Germany. So they are part of the majority population. So they are treated like equals, at least as citizens, with full voting rights and so on. So in all of these cases, I think what we see is that in terms of education, at least the next generation is doing really well and often better than the comparison group of other people of the same population that were not forced to migrate. So this uprootedness hypothesis we talked about seems to work its magic in many contexts. Then also in the case of population exchanges, which happened as the British Empire collapsed and India and Pakistan arose as new nations, and Hindus moved to India and Muslims moved to Pakistan. Also there, overall, those refugees seem to have done really well, even if maybe initially there is a lot of challenge to even find a place to live. So overall, I would say the picture is a positive one, and we should not worry too much about these refugees, especially since over time, a lot of things heal. Another example I find quite fascinating is natural disaster that is also in the survey. And it's the last episode I cover because it happens just months before my birth, and which was my cutoff for history. So in the context of Iceland, there was a volcano outbreak on an island off Iceland, on the Westman Islands. And that volcano outbreak hit various houses, and the flying ash would go somehow randomly in also remoter parts of that island. So some houses burned down, some didn't, in neighboring houses. So some people would leave the island, move to Reykjavik, to the capital city, and others stay behind. And this being an agricultural island, a fishing island, more or less, those that move to Reykjavik are suddenly have completely different opportunities, and they no longer just take the dad's business and become fishermen, but now they might become bankers. So the authors of that work, they call it the gift of moving, because sometimes people may also be stuck in a place where their opportunities are limited. So what all of that is saying is that, of course, it's terrible and these people would maybe never want to move, but there are also cases where moving puts them on a better trajectory for the future.
What about the people that live in communities that receive migrants? You hear a lot of worries from all over the world, from Brazil and Colombia, from Turkey with Syrian migrants, across Europe. Are they right to be worried about the effects on their communities?
I do understand the worries, for sure. And there is a mix of economic arguments, they are taking away my jobs, to also cultural arguments. So take the German case, the Syrian refugee crisis, where Germany opened its doors to Syrian refugees and more than a million came. And there, the concern by many is more on the cultural side. Oh, these are not Christians, they are Muslims, and they are different. And how do we deal with that? But Angela Merkel had this famous sentence, wir schaffen das, we can do it. And she essentially tried to invite fellow Germans to just give it a try. And as far as I can see from the ongoing work by labor economists, most Syrian refugees have integrated extremely well because these people are keen to make a living and they want to be good fellow citizens. And those narratives of, oh, there may be the odd terrorist coming along as well, they are just scaremongering, in my view.
Some of the most infamous episodes of forced migration, and the obvious one, of course, is slavery, but we could also maybe think about the forced migration of Jews out of Europe to the United States, have undoubtedly benefited the receiving countries. But can we also then identify how much they weaken the countries from which those migrants left?
Yeah, I think we can. So talking about slavery, there is a fascinating work by Nathan Nunn and Leonard Van Chikon that says that in those places where slaves were taken in Africa in the 19th century, even today, trust levels are lower. And why is that? Because the way some people think about slavery is, oh, the Americans came, they took slaves, they shipped them away. But in order for them to be shipped away, there had to be some chief, some tribes leader who would be willing to also give away people. And there was a lot of betrayal also between neighboring tribes that you would ship off your own cousins. And that has sowed the seed of distrust that still haunts these places today. And in the case of Jewish refugees, some work I've also been doing myself is on that of Jewish academics who were expelled from Nazi Germany. Germany before World War II was what the US is today, the place with the most Nobel laureates. And Hitler essentially sent them away for racial reasons. And that is one of the reasons for the transition in leadership. And Germany has never again held position number one as the leading science nation.
As you mentioned earlier, the plight of indigenous peoples who were displaced when colonists came to their countries. You spent a lot of your time in Australia. That's become part of the news there. That's discussed ethically. It's discussed socially. Does economic history have much to say about this?
Yeah, I think so. We can learn from data again, and these episodes where kids are removed from their families and sent to boarding schools, mm-hmm. a lot of that went into the 20th century, where also we then have pretty decent data and where we don't even have to dig back too deep into the archives. And there is a mix of results. Some people find that in terms of educational attainment, these kids being sent to boarding schools are doing relatively well. And maybe not surprisingly, if you are put into a school and you are not allowed to leave, well, you finish school at some point. Yeah? But the real cost to these people is that they are being brainwashed to some extent, mm-hmm. and they lose the contact to their upbringing. And I think that is a terrible cost to pay, because I have very high esteem for Indigenous Australians, and it's absolutely fascinating how they live in unity with nature. There could be so much to learn from also for our challenges with climate change and so on. But a lot of these people were given a blow to their cultural heritage there.
When you look at these examples that you pull together, all of it's interesting. Some of it is inspiring. Some of it's actually horrifying. There must be a lot more work yet to do. What do you think is the most interesting, underexplored area of the historical economic research into displacement?
That is a tough one, because I think there are still many gaps. If we think about history in the sense that, okay, which episodes have already been researched, I would think there is still a lot to be done. And one way to think about it is, oh, what has the highest insight also from an economics point of view? How can we learn from modern day policies about what happened in history? And I think all of that is valid. But the one thing I learned also from my research into Jewish academics is it is just so incredibly important to also honor the plight of these people. So when I did this research, I then tried to reconstruct with my co-authors the biographies of Jewish academics. And of course, for the Einsteins of this world, we know pretty much everything, but there were also Jewish academics that are lesser known. So we spend a lot of time trying to find out details of their life, where they worked, and whether they were married, had kids, and all of that. In some cases, we uncovered details that even the descendants of these people didn't know. So I was emailing then with descendants of some of the survivors of the Holocaust, and they said, I'm so thankful that you have uncovered this. We didn't even know. And giving a memorial to people whose life was so deeply affected by a mix of racism and brutality is, I think, so important. We owe it to these people or to their descendants that their lives are documented.
Sascha Becker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
If you read this paper, I can guarantee that you will find out something that you did not know, and you will also find some research and you'll think, I'm going to read that as well. So it is called Forced Displacement in History, Some Recent Research, author Sascha Becker, of course. It is discussion paper 17077 at CEPR. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want to know what you're going to be reading in journals 18 months from now, listen to Vox Talks Economics today. This paper is actually published as well, isn't it, Sasha?
Yeah, that's right. It just came out in the Australian Economic History Review, and incidentally and tragically in the middle of this crazy war on Ukraine.
When you subscribe to Vox Talks, please do, wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find that there's well than 200 episodes now. So whatever type of economics you like, well, there will be a Vox Talk waiting for you.